Hello, everyone. Welcome to Talking Logistics, where we have conversations with thought leaders in the supply chain logistics industry. And it's my great pleasure to welcome today's program Sarah Rathke, who is a partner at Squire Patent Boggs. And today we're going to talk about the legal perspective on developing successful supply chain relationships. Now, you know, this is a topic that I've written a lot about over the past, couple of years. And it's an area that's gaining more and more attention as supply chains become much more complex. And you've got so many different pressures out there that you're seeing, unfortunately, you know, more and more examples out there of supply chain disputes or supply chain relationships that have kind of gone south. And I think, you know, this is a great opportunity to really talk through, you know, this topic and understand, you know, what are the key attributes that will make for a successful supply chain relationship. And Sarah here is an expert on this topic. And certainly welcome her to the program to be able to discuss this in more detail. You know, for those of you that are joining us live today, if you do have a question, for Sarah, you can do so via the submit a question button or via the chat feature. And certainly if we've got time and it's a good and appropriate question, I'll weave it into the conversation. So with that, Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Adrian.
You know, Sarah, before we kind of dive into this topic, you know, whenever I have a new guest on the program, I always like to kind of get a little bit of understanding of their background and how they got involved with this industry in general. And you're a little bit different than my previous guests because you come at it from a kind of law profession. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your practice and how and why you ended up specializing in, you know, litigating supply chain disputes?
Sure. So I'm, like you said, I'm a partner in the trial group at Squire Patent Boggs, and I'm in the Cleveland office. And being in Cleveland, we are sort of at the heart of the manufacturing part of the United States, or at least one of the hearts of it. And supply chain disputes between suppliers and buyers engaged in the cooperative process of making things, that was something, those sorts of disputes were the ones that kept coming across my desk. And I began to realize that there are certain common mistakes that tend to create disputes more than others. And then conversely, there are sort of common practices that enable supply chain partners to avoid disputes. And that's the origin of how I got interested in it as a distinct and unique kind of litigation, and one where counseling is also appropriate.
That's great. I definitely want to, you know, talk about some of those common mistakes or common issues that arise, a little bit later here in the conversation. But let's start with, you know, a case that we saw in the headlines, you know, a few weeks back, you know, certainly toward the last part of last year. That was kind of the Apple and GT Advanced Technologies. And you know, I think that's become a kind of a great example of a supply chain relationship that went wrong. And, you know, to many observers, including me, you know, Apple kind of came across as a bully, you know, putting, you know, risky and costly, you know, conditions upon, you know, into the agreement. And while others looked at GTAT and said, well, how can they even, you know, accept, you know, such a lousy agreement, you know, especially its legal team. I'm sure you kind of are aware of that case. I mean, as a legal professional, you know, when you know, what were your key takeaways from that case based on the information that was, you know, publicly available, and what can supply chain professionals and legal teams kind of take away from it?
Sure. First, some background for your viewers. The GT Advanced case was arose as a result of a supply chain relationship between GT Advanced and Apple in connection with making screens for iPhone 6. Apple iPhone and iPad screens traditionally are made out of something called Gorilla Glass, which is pretty strong, but Apple conceived of an idea of making those screens out of sapphire. Manufactured synthetic sapphire, which is even stronger, more scratch resistant. So the parties were doing something new. Apple approached GT Advanced, and GT Advanced and Apple entered into a contract to provide the sapphire material for these screens. The relationship did go south and ended up with GT Advanced filing bankruptcy and then Apple making claims against the bankrupt estate, the reorganizing estate, for breach of the party's supply chain agreement. And of course, the supply chain agreement never fully became public information. So, you know, basing this on what is public, it looks like what went wrong was primarily, and I see this all the time, and sometimes there's as much at stake as there was in GT Advanced, and sometimes there isn't. But what went wrong is that the parties were developing a new technology, something that GT Advanced had never done before. Probably something that, at least in the commercial quantities contemplated by the parties, that nobody had done before. And so they had a development agreement, and they tied their development agreement to production. And in other words, they entered into a very big production level agreement spanning years, putting lots of money, hundreds of millions of dollars at stake. And they hinged that agreement to the success of the development program, and not only just to its succeeding technically, but to its succeeding on the time frame and in the cost parameters contemplated by the parties. And it would be nice if that worked out all the time, but of course, the unexpected always happens. And, you know, the product didn't develop like the parties want. Now, to your question, was Apple a bully? Was GT Advanced foolish? You know, maybe, but I think the bottom line there for people looking to learn from this experience is that nobody won. The bully didn't win if Apple was a bully, and I'm not saying that it was or wasn't. GT Advanced certainly didn't win, even if it was foolish, and I'm not saying it was or it wasn't. But the parties mutually engaged in a very costly gamble, and that resulted in failure of the program, and I'm sure added costs to both parties, not just GT Advanced, but Apple too, who had to, of course, approach its original glass supplier in order to get the iPhone 6 out in time for, you know, Christmas.
That's a great insight there, which resonates with me. I mean, I started my career at Motorola doing manufacturing and new product development, and that was always one of the cardinal rules around new product development, is that you never wanted to be in the R&D phase and developing some new technology, some new invention, while also hinging that or linking that to real manufacturing commitments, right? So if you're trying to invent and innovate at the same time that you're trying to meet some deadline, you were setting yourself up, but more likely than not for failure. And to your point, I think that obviously played a key role here. And I think you're right. I mean, obviously, at the end of the day, this became a lose-lose proposition for both, regardless of what role each of them played in terms of their approach to the relationship. That's one example. I mean, as you look across kind of the other types of disputes, and you kind of mentioned this before, that there are some kind of commonality that you see out there. What are some of these common disputes that you see out there, supply chain disputes that you encounter?
I think, like what I said before, anytime people are making something new, that adds a degree of difficulty and peril to a supply chain relationship. I mean, nobody ever sues their bolt manufacturer, right? I mean, it's always when you're developing something complex where components have to interact with one another. If you add software, that's, of course, a greater degree of difficulty because software interacts uniquely with just about everything. And then something doesn't go as expected. And in a complex part, in a complex product where new technology is being used or developed, nothing ever goes fully as anybody expects. And then the question is your relationship strong enough and robust enough to work through the problems? And is your contract strong enough and robust enough to work through the products? And both are important. I know a lot of times practitioners, folks in the industry, supply chain professionals, think it all comes down to relationship. And a lot of times it does. But the supply chain agreement, knowing for sure what your rights and obligations are, that frames the relationship in a very real sense.
So when you look at kind of the root causes of these supply chain disputes, I mean, is there a common thread between them? In other words, is it possible to say, gosh, if the parties had only done X, these disputes would never have happened?
There are a few common threads that I see. One of them, though, and I think it's an important one, and I think it's one that's easy to fix, is that each party, buyer and supplier, what often goes wrong is that the buyer in its own organization or the supplier in its own organization is not fully integrating its constituencies that are going to be involved in a supply chain relationship. In other words, perhaps contract administration, perhaps that function is negotiating the agreement. And engineers maybe have something to do with the specifications that go with that agreement, but they don't understand the commercial realities of it, and then the commercial people don't understand the impact that the engineering specifications will have on the relationship. Parties internally need to do a better job of getting together so that they understand the implications of the things that they are agreeing to, which means that engineering has to interact with legal, with contract management, and with finance sometimes with quality and reliability, and sometimes with manufacturing, to understand all of the parameters of what this agreement is really going to involve. And I know that it's more complex and people resist doing it. And I understand that there are commodity parts and commodity style agreements that don't need that. But if you are doing something new, something high value, or something complex, it really is an ounce of prevention worth versus a pound of cure.
That's great. I think it leads me to the next question, because I think from my perspective, I'm gonna give you my answer first before I even ask the question, because I think it relates to what you just said. I think a lot of times what ends up happening, legal is the last to get involved, right? It's like, hey, we've talked to this, we've come to an agreement, and then legal gets it. They're in there at the 11th hour. And of course, legal hasn't been involved all along. And now they have to kind of try to put the pieces in place. So this leads me to my next question, which is, because that happens, I think the perception about legal is that, you know, their main role in this whole process is really to protect their own company and to shift as much risk and cost to the other party as possible. And, so it's kind of, I think ultimately what ends up leading is, you know, a lot of companies kind of approach the parties approach the table each from a, you know, we're going to kind of minimize our risk, our liability, so on and so forth. How can the legal team enable and help in providing and enabling a more highly collaborative relationship and kind of not be viewed as kind of inhibiting it with, you know, putting in terms and conditions and all sorts of things in there to kind of protect the company, which, I mean, I assume that's still part of the responsibility of corporate legal is to, you know, make sure that they're not putting the company at some kind of unfair risk.
Yes, I understand what you're talking about. Thank you for your question. I think that the perception may be that supply chain agreements are over-lawyered. In my view, and this is just my view, supply chain agreements are woefully under-lawyered in a sense. Take a $500 million mergers and acquisitions type transaction at a corporation. That thing is lawyered to the hilt. There are lawyers crawling around doing diligence to ascertain exactly how much risk is being assumed or proposed, interacting with business to determine how much exposure businesses has an appetite for. If there are foreign jurisdictions involved, you'll get lawyers from those foreign jurisdictions to determine the parameters of operating in the foreign jurisdiction and the legalities. Take a $500 million supply chain dispute, though, and that may go through one guy at the last minute or, you know, near the end phases of the agreement's negotiation in-house. And as a result, he's doing what you say he's doing, which is that he just sees this agreement and he's trying to protect the interests of the company, not necessarily knowing everything that is going into that agreement. As I said before, companies are better off when they fully understand the risk and all the implications of their supply chain agreements. Lawyers who haven't been involved in the process are pretty much forced into a position of being strictly defensive. They can sort of trust their business counterparts and hope that they've got the positive side, but the positive side and the negative side are never fully separate. So that lawyer is doing what he can, but at times I'm sure he can be seen as being an obstacle to cooperation and success. That said, the notion that there is some legal magic that can be done around the drafting of an agreement to ensure a collaborative spirit going forward is probably false, right? I mean, fundamentally what the lawyers are there to do is to protect the company, to make sure everybody understands the amount of risk that's being adopted and assumed, and to have some concrete idea of what your legal rights and responsibilities are. They're lawyers, they're not magicians. That's about as much as they can do. It's up to the parties going forward to adopt practices that ensure a good relationship. But one foundational thing that is needed, you can't have a good relationship without it, is a solid, unambiguous sense of where you stand with each other. And that's what the agreement provides. That starts first. Collaboration builds from there.
You know, I think just to reiterate, I guess, what we both said, you know, I think you start out by saying, you know, in many ways you can look at it that the process, I mean, lawyers are there's not enough lawyers, if you will. The lawyer's not involved as much. You know, I think the way I look at it is that they're not leveraged or utilized as a partner early enough in the process, right, to really pave the way for what would ultimately be a successful, you know, not only agreement, but a framework for a relationship, you know, moving forward. So my takeaway from your comments is that, you know, really look at the legal team as a partner that you should utilize and leverage as early on in the process as possible, so that they can provide their input, their advice, and be as knowledgeable about what it is that both parties are trying to achieve, particularly with these more complex deals, which ideally ought to be more longer term, ought to be, you know, have higher desired outcomes, more valuable desired outcomes for both parties. And the sooner you can get legal as part of that process, as part of the conversation, you know, the more effective and more win-win it will be for everybody involved. Did I paraphrase that? Okay.
Yeah, I think that you absolutely did. I think that the earlier legal is involved, and the more that, not just legal, but the more that the company in general understands what it is doing, fully understands, the more that all the constituencies get involved, that's where you have the best agreements, and that's where you have the best relationships.
You know, along the same lines, you know, when I talk to a lot of supply chain executives, you know, one of the things that they always tell me is that they, you know, one of the skills that they're looking to develop is to become better at finance, right? Or become knowledgeable at finance, because they want to be able to speak the language of the CFO, right? So that if they're trying to position some investment or be able to get some support for a supply chain project, you know, they want to be able to put it in the terms that the CFO understands and the CEO understands, which is, you know, again, for many cases, it's dollars and cents. So a lot of these executives that might have come up through engineering or some other background are kind of, that's where they're looking to develop their skills, is, you know, they're taking finance courses or trying to understand the financial side more. So I'm kind of curious. I mean, I'm wondering here, as we're having our conversation here, is, do you believe there's a similar value in supply chain executives kind of becoming better versed on the legal side of supply chain, and vice versa for, you know, the legal team to become better versed in supply chain?
Yes, I do. And it's not hard. I mean, it's what a supply chain relationship fundamentally is a legal one. And I know that there are logistics aspects to it too, but if you don't understand the legal foundation, there are pitfalls there. And I think that you can have a very big program, and you can have project managers in charge of a very big program at a company, sort of, you know, doing the day-to-day management that's required without ever having read the agreement between the parties, and without, you know, therefore without at least knowingly observing what the parties' rights and responsibilities are. And I see this all the time, because usually when, you know, by the time it comes to my desk, and increasingly less so, people are now seeking out advice more proactively, but most of all, when it comes to my desk, the parties aren't, they're not working together anymore. They're, you know, they're doing this. And when they're doing this, and, you know, somebody has filed a case or is about to file a case, there is no activity, there's no action, there's no behavior, there's no comment, there's no word that one side can say that will be taken well by the other side. I mean, it's like any relationship. When it gets to that point, it is probably beyond repair. I've seen things get together, but only after a certain amount of mutually assured destruction. So yes, I think that sometimes on the practitioner side, understanding the legal side would help sort of know what, at least you're going to know when you're falling off of the cliff. And then, you know, you can make the conscious choice to fall off the cliff or not. The point is that you know what you're doing. And then I think on the legal side, the reason that I chose to specialize or to focus on this particular type of dispute is that I noticed that there is a function and a rhythm to manufacturing, to the supply chain organization, to engineering, that was coming up again in every case, you know, the engineering principles, and having a scientific understanding and a technical understanding of those things helped me understand much more what was going on, and helped me deal with the people who are my witnesses, you know, who eventually, when we go to court, you know, somebody's got to climb up in that chair and they don't like it, but it helped me understand their experience much better because I had seen so many of these disputes and because I had been involved in engineering for, you know, most of my career.
That's great, you know, great insight. I mean, and you know, kind of along the same lines of, you know, understanding the supply chain. You know, are you seeing any kind of supply chain trends, kind of emerging trends that are, you know, presenting new legal questions or challenges for companies that, you know, particularly in how they manage their relationships?
Yes, I think in the last 5 years, and it's only going to get more so, visibility into the supply chain is a bigger thing. And there are lots of reasons. There are lots of things that supply chain, that companies need to see all the way down their supply chain on. You know, compliance with anti-corruption legislation, conflicts, minerals type things. There's increasing legislation that makes companies have to be aware and to report on whether their supply chains use labor conditions that our government disapproves of. Disaster, you know, as weather becomes more of an issue, it's important to know what your supplier's disaster plans are and to know what you're going to do in case there's a disaster, in case there's a tsunami in Japan, or a fire in your factory in Bangladesh. People need to know more now what is going on with their suppliers. And people try to do that on the fly, you know, the disaster supplier, you know, okay, so where are you on conflicts minerals? And then the supplier may or may not answer. I mean, these relationships and getting this information is complicated often by time zone issues, international issues, things that have cultural overlays. And the best way to deal with it is to just require it up front when you can in the supplier agreement. Just say, you know, as one of the conditions of us doing business with you, we are going to need regular updates to your disaster readiness plan. We are going to need the right to audit your disaster readiness plan. We are going to know need to know where you are on conflicts minerals. These are things we need to know. And if it's required in the agreement, then there can't really be any pushback.
Now, I mean, obviously, there's, you know, things that are happening here in the U.S. You know, companies that are multinational, you know, they've got to comply with, you know, rules and regulations in the other company, you know, other countries that they operate in. So I assume there's a amount of collaboration or communication needs to take place, you know, to understand the global or international implications that might be involved from other rules and regulations from other countries that, you know, would help inform the overall agreement. Is that correct?
That is correct. And it's not just for companies whose own operations are international, but it's also for companies whose supply chains are international. Because in certain cases, companies can be held liable, you know, for what's going on over there, even if it's a separate company that's doing it. So, I mean, I guess the only thing that I would say is that the worst way to find out what your obligations are is the hard way. And so to the extent that, I mean, you know, there are people out there who have the information, a short consultation can probably save you at least a lot of heartache and sleepless nights.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're kind of running out of time here, so I've got a couple of more questions here. Now I know that you recently wrote a book, it's yet to be published, but I'm kind of curious. I mean, tell us a little bit about, you know, what's the title of the book? When will it be available? And why did you decide to write a book? I mean, what are the kind of the key messages you want to communicate, you and your co-author, around this book?
Yes. Well, so my very good friend and I, who became a good friend because I hired her as an expert witness in supply chain issues from the business side. Her name is Rosemary Coates. We were trying a case together one day with others, and you know, we just decided, we were talking about the things that commonly go wrong, and she kind of sees it from her end on the business end, and I sort of see the legal aspects of it. And we thought, wouldn't it be nice? Oh, and we looked on Amazon to see if there was a book about supply chain legal disputes or, you know, having harmonious supply chain relationships. There wasn't. And so we thought, wouldn't it be better if there was something out there that people could consult ahead of time that might make it easier to avoid some of these really financial disastrous pitfalls that they fall into. And both from Rosemary's side, she's a consultant, and from mine, I mean, we serve a variety of different roles. I mean, sort of to analogize this to the medical profession, you know, we could be in trial, and in that case, you're, well, put it this way, we could come at the relationship, or we could come at the company from a totally advisory role, you know, to look over the health of their relationships, and then we're sort of like the primary care doctor. We could be called in when a relationship is starting to be troubled, and then we're a treating doctor. Or most often, what we do is when we're in litigation, and I mean, we're just like the mortician, you know, at that point, trying to assess the cause of death. And I think most people would rather just go to their primary care doctor.
That's a great analogy. Now, what's the title of the book, and when will it be published?
Right. Sorry. The title of the book is called Legal Blacksmith: Avoiding and Defending Supply Chain Disputes, and it will be out this spring.
Well, I agree. I you know, when I first came across that note that you had written a book, and I don't recall seeing a book along those same lines, and so certainly look forward to reading it. And I guess to wrap up, you know, I'm sure there'll be more nuggets like this in the book. I mean, what advice would you give to supply chain professionals and their legal teams, you know, to help them, you know, develop, you know, successful long-term, you know, supplier relationships, and to minimize the risk of, you know, ending up in the mortician's table there?
I hate when people ask that, because the answer sounds so pithy, and I'm sure people watching are going to be like, oh God, I knew she was going to say. The answer really is, I mean, it really is, I really mean this. People say this all the time, but here it's really true. The answer is, there is no such thing as too much communication within your own company, so you know how your actions are impacting others, and with the other side, so that small problems don't become big problems. A lot of times when things break out into litigation, somebody had a bad feeling 6 months ago and, you know, either didn't have the authority to deal with it, had some institutional obstacles that prevented them from dealing with it. Maybe they tried to deal with it and it didn't work. Maybe they didn't get anybody's attention. But somebody always knew, somebody always saw this coming. And you find it in the emails afterwards. There's always some guy who's like, oh, this is terrible. This is up. We're just throwing it over the fence here. And he's right. That guy is always right. So communication internally and with your supply chain partners is really the thing that avoids trouble.
No, I think it's always worth reminding. I mean, I think it's the underlying truth to any kind of relationship, not only business relationship, but obviously personal relationships as well. I mean, I think it's something that's a universal, you know, truth. And I think going back to something we already discussed is, you know, obviously, you know, taking a more collaborative approach, bringing in all the stakeholders that are going to be involved in making this a successful relationship, involved as early on in the process, and obviously including the legal team as part of that, you know, rather than at the 11th hour, where you know, it becomes much more difficult to, you know, and puts the legal team in a much different position than if they were involved all along in the conversation. So, you know, Sarah, great. I mean, I always end all my programs, you always manage to just scratch the surface on these topics, but I think you provided some great insights, some great food for thought. You know, certainly look forward to the book being published and reading that, and we'll welcome you back on the program, you know, later this year to maybe discuss some of the additional nuggets of insight, you know, from that book. So again, thank you for making the time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And I want to thank all of you who joined us today. And if you're watching this program on demand, and you have a question for Sarah, you can post the question via that medium. Just search for the episode on talkinglogistics.com and post a comment there, and I'm sure Sarah will be more than happy to respond via that platform. So with that, again, thank you very much for joining us today, and look forward to seeing you in a future episode of Talking Logistics.
Thank you very much.
Have a great day.